President Smith, distinguished guests, parents, and students. I'm very happy to be here today, to be with you to say goodbye. Look around you at this glorious place, the trees, the light filtering through the leaves, the creek that flows to the Delaware, the birds singing. In this beautiful place that has been my home and home to so many Swarthmore rites of passage, they are dear to us. This is my last graduation. I am heading out, as you seniors are, into a much larger world full of wonder and challenge. It's both daunting and exciting, and it thrills me, and I hope all of you, to jump into the new and the unknown. It also invites us to have a healthy skepticism about what the moral climate of the world out there is like. We have been deeply educated here at Swarthmore to think long and hard about the unexamined assumptions of the world we live in, the intellectual, spiritual, and political commonplaces of our time. We have learned history, biology, and the aesthetic meanings of a multitude of interpretations that inform every action we take and every challenge we face. And things are looking a little bit chaotic out there at the moment. We have learned to analyze critically, but that may seem inadequate to the mounting chaos around us. There are some strange and frankly unimaginable characters on the stage at the moment. Not only politically, but environmentally, things aren't looking real stable. I'm going to talk today about some of the grave issues we face, about the political and spiritual tasks that faced my generation, at what we accomplished and what we failed to accomplish, in order to appreciate the unprecedented perils that your generation faces, even more urgent and life-threatening in a way than ours. I will be 70 years old in September, which is astonishing to me. I belong to a previous age. I belong to the age of books. We are the last print generation. We are becoming extinct. The age that is dawning is more and more beyond my ken. It is literally a new world of technology and communications and interconnections I can only vaguely imagine. You do not think when you are 20 that someday you will be 70, looking back over your life. I was 20 in 1966. We were in the middle of the Vietnam War, in the middle of a real, down and dirty, in the streets, in your face, often violent revolution. The 1968 Democratic Convention had riots in the streets, and we were the rioters. After the death of Robert Kennedy, the Democratic Party nominated Hubert Humphrey, as opposed to Eugene McCarthy, who was the Bernie Sanders of our time. I was born in Miami, Florida, and I attended segregated schools there, entirely segregated schools. I was active in the civil rights movement in the South in the 60s. I went to Tulane University in New Orleans for college, and we desegregated every lunch counter and cafe in the city and got arrested for it. I canvassed for LBJ in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965, recently gutted by the Supreme Court. We lived in the middle of a giant, volatile, frightening, and thrilling political moment, informed by the violence of three assassinations, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and Bobby Kennedy, the leaders of our time, murdered. I have always wondered what things would have been like if they had lived. With civil rights and the Vietnam War, the question of violence and nonviolence rippled through our lives. It took me a long time to conclude that nonviolence is the only revolution that works, that all you need is love. This great movement of the 60s and 70s led progressively, not smoothly, in overlapping stages from the civil rights movement to the anti-war movement, the women's rights movement, and ultimately to the gay rights movement. Each powerful cause enlisting millions of people in a multi-pronged, unrelenting drive toward justice. It changed its name and its foci, it split and regathered, but it was a sweeping tide of change in the direction of greater equality, inclusion, and justice. But it was not peaceful. Poor black neighborhoods were burning by the end of the decade. However, it was also a time of great joy. We were young and free and alive with the untold possibility of the new post-war world, its prosperity and its hope. The music alone, live, freshly invented rock and roll, seized our consciousness and transformed it. From Dylan and Joan Baez to Led Zeppelin, the range of sounds and feelings was indescribable. I will never forget seeing Janis Joplin sing in New Orleans. I will never forget her face, her music, or her death. My friends and I experienced the joyous opening up of sexuality for women after millennia of repression. We no longer had to be ladies. We dared to express ourselves in ways we had never before, and it was a way into a future we were only beginning to imagine. We marched together, people of all ages and races and beliefs, gathering in the same rallies, singing the same songs, united in a solidarity and passionate conviction that innocent people, far from here in their own country and near to here in ours, should not be oppressed and massacred. We didn't think about the earth yet, though napalm gave us a big hint. For me, the civil rights movement was the most urgent and obvious, the one worth going to jail for and getting beaten up over. It grew out of our childhood. I went to entirely segregated schools. I was raised by three generations of black women from one family, Pinky, Dorothy, and Daisy. I don't know their last name, of course. It's a cliche, but I love them. Daisy was my age at the time I was in high school, and we used to run off together and get in trouble and get yelled at by my mother. Daisy was not going to be a maid. She was going to work in a bank. We agreed on that. Once we opened our eyes, it was self-evident that black people should be free to eat in any restaurant, go to any school, vote for any candidate, have any career, live their own lives. Black Americans were not really people to those who denied and chained and oppressed them, and I identified with them. It was obvious that we had to fight to change those conditions and consciousness. And we did make progress. African Americans are now in Congress and colleges and universities at all levels, if not yet in fair or great enough numbers. They are doctors and lawyers and presidents of the United States. Our generation began that work, but it still remains to be accomplished. African Americans are also massively overrepresented in the nation's prisons. Mass incarceration and the police brutality that generates it constitute the most obvious and harrowing version of American slavery now, and it should be screaming out for action as it was 50 years ago. Black lives matter. But the resistance of 50 years ago is still with us. The anti-war movement was also necessary and compelling. They were killing millions of people unjustly and horribly, and they were sending us, our brothers and fathers and lovers, to kill or be killed. Americans were napalming villages and devastating the landscape and decimating the population in another country. We ended the war and a presidency, but peace was short-lived. We have been at war in Afghanistan longer than all the other wars combined. We are still bombing villages from even farther away. 22 combat veterans in America kill themselves every day. 22 combat veterans kill themselves every day. This is what war does to us. The most important cause for me personally was the women's movement. Women were coming awake after 1,000 years. For all the history of Western civilization, we had been silenced. We were owned, controlled, protected, abused, imprisoned, used for whatever a man wanted, and not allowed out in public. With few exceptions, half the human race had not been allowed to speak, to earn a living, to own property, to have any place at the table when the decisions about their lives, their towns, their countries, cities, hospitals, courts, markets were being made. We were silenced. We decided and declared that this was over. We were human beings with equal rights and equal voices. We fought for our places in the world, inserted ourselves into the conversation, seized the honors and the failures, the offices and the privileges that are the prizes and costs of life in this society. We were entitled to a place, to power, to a voice, because we are human beings, like African Americans, Native Americans, LGBT Americans, agnostic Americans, immigrant Americans, like propertied white men, and of course not like propertied white men. We have moved eventually even to understand non-human animals as having, and ecosystems themselves as having due to respect and rights that they deserve. I cherish the memory of the slow movement of consciousness as it opened in me in the 70s. The slow tide of dawning recognition as we began to understand what it meant that we had been excluded from all public life for all of history. Why? It grew out of physical dominance and violence, all right, but that's not an adequate answer for 5,000 years of erasing us. It is a question we still can't answer, but we could change it. It was not an easy fight. Do not think it was easy. We had to go to jail. We had to fight with all our might, our brains, our bodies, our lives. We had to put up with all the insults and refusals, the ridicule, the assaults, and the sheer denials. When I went to college, there was only one woman professor in the university and no professors of color anywhere in the university. I went to Princeton to get my PhD after I spent 2 years in London at the height of the international students movement. We shut down the London School of Economics for 6 months. Bill Clinton was there, and so was Mick Jagger. I was not personally friends with them. When I got to Princeton, they had just admitted women as undergraduates the previous year. My sister-in-law Jean went to Boston College Law School, and only 10% of the students in the law school were women. We were the beginning. When I got my first teaching job at UNC Chapel Hill, as my students must get tired of me telling them, I was the only woman, the sole only woman, in a 40-man department of political science, the only woman in a 7-story building housing political science, history, and economics. Joan Scott says she was also there hiding on the 7th floor. That may be true. I was handled, touched, verbally harassed by the men in that department in every way you could conceive of. I was their daughter, their lover, their sister, their mother, their team mascot. I was anything but an equal intellectual colleague. I eventually gave it up and went home to get married. The ultimate cop-out, as it was thought then. But I came back. Please remember that we are only one generation away from these changes. We are an inch deep and an inch wide into the fight for justice in this country and the world. The fight is yours to continue. And as you can see, the opposition is alive and strong. Racists and homophobes, sexists and nationalists are the enemy for me. They have been since they killed JFK. Do these words, sexist, bigot, racist, nationalist, call anyone to mind? Is there a face to go with these words? I am not consumed by hatred or rage, which is tempting in these times. But I have a clear, deep determination to fight until my last breath those who sacrifice the lives and well-being of others for power and greed and wealth. It doesn't have to be loud or savage. The fight just has to be heartfelt, firm, and full of the strength of will. You will face the same challenges and worse ones, and I hope that we have given you the tools for developing your own determination to see what in the world needs to be replenished, rejuvenated, transformed, and healed, and the strength to do it. We did accomplish some of the more important things in my lifetime, in my generation. We fought against the Vietnam War because our survival was at stake, and that threat penetrated our elite bubble and grabbed our attention. But we also fought because we had the tools, the confidence, and the responsibility from our privileged position to take on the fight. You are also in such a privileged position. You also face a fight for survival, and you also have the tools, the confidence, and the responsibility to take on the fight. We have bequeathed to you a multitude of consequences from the wars of race, class, and gender that began 50 years ago. We accomplished much of what we set out to do, and yet so much remains to be done. Blacks, women, Latinos, queers, immigrants are in every profession, except perhaps high finance capital. They are in the law courts and Supreme Courts, in the hospitals and medical schools and research labs, in universities and colleges, in Congress, in the military, in the high worlds of culture, art, and fashion. We were not in any of these places when I was growing up. You have to know how short it has been since this has changed. I look at my classes, and more than half the people in them are minorities of one sort or another, and they struggle with all the complexities of meeting each other and coming to terms with their differences and their histories of domination and suffering. There have been some almighty arguments in my classes, and that's all to the good. My ethics class asked us to include a week on sex and violence this semester. And I said, you can do it if you find the readings. They found the readings. There were some pretty good discussions from that week. Talking about what is hard to talk about is the first step. It's important that you all know that you are breaking new ground here. And it is not expected to be easy or safe. We do not know all the answers as to how to represent ourselves or speak for us or our people, whoever they are. But we are learning how to do so. The whole world is at the table now, taking part in the great decisions of our time, at least in theory. In practice, of course, billions of people lack water, sanitation, food, housing, the internet, and a voice. We have achieved a salutary diversity here at Swarthmore. But Swarthmore is a small island of enlightenment, a small part of a vast continent of division, inequality, and violence. We accomplished the beginnings of the establishment of equal justice in my time, but you are reaping the unfinished work of making it real. And much more dangerous, you are facing the organized, well-financed backlash, the hatred and rage of those who are being replaced and won't go quietly. They have found their leader, it seems. Trump might very well win. With the perspective of 40 years of teaching political science, I say to you that fascism is raising its head high in America right now. It has marshaled its forces, amassed billions of dollars, built institutes and think tanks, endowed chairs, and bought political candidates in order to further a deeply racist, sexist, armed, incendiary, business as usual capitalist agenda, built on the fear of displacement and the profits from fossil fuels. I'll get to fossil fuels. We cannot turn our faces away. We cannot pretend that deportations might not be right around the corner. If we have to choose who to defend, whom to help, we have to remember what deportations can lead to. It's easy to look back and think that all we accomplished was bound to happen. All people were going to be included in the American dream. But it was not bound to happen. It did not happen for 2,000 years. The oldest institution on the planet, the Catholic Church, gentle Pope Francis notwithstanding, is still all men talking to all men. Wall Street is virtually the same. The centers of real power have remained the exclusive domain of property, white men. This is not politically correct. This is factually true. It is important to understand, it is important that you understand, that what has been gained in a generation can be lost in a generation. There is only one generation separating us. You have to know the history you are sitting in. You have to be aware of how precarious is the justice that we take for granted and want to improve. It is right that people at Swarthmore care deeply about preventing rape and sexual violence on campus, and will no longer tolerate the disrespect, abuse, and harassment of some of the people around them. But you are not the victims of the college or this time. You are experiencing the continuation of the ancient domination of women and people of color that has always existed in America and continues to gather strength. You are wholly enmeshed in the fight. You were born into it. And maybe, like my generation, it will take all of your lifetimes to accomplish something lasting. That's how long it takes. It will take time and effort, compassion, and perseverance. You are doing the work. You have the capacity to do all that you can envision. And you have been raised up to the responsibility to do it. You could start with the greatest challenge you face, the greatest challenge any generation has faced, I think. As I say in my classes, the seas will rise for 1,000 years. And there's not much we can do about it now. Climate change is the greatest threat the human species has ever encountered. We encounter this threat on behalf of all the species on the planet. Some of us are already devoting our lives to this problem. Some of us know about this in our hearts, but don't know what to do about it. And some of us are afraid even to think about it. All of us share these attributes. Since the Industrial Revolution, we have been pouring greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and it is warming the temperature of the planet, starting at the poles. It is changing the face of the Earth as we know it. We are facing what scientists are calling the sixth extinction, an event characterized by the loss of between 17,000 and 100,000 species each year. The last great extinction of this size occurred 65 million years ago. Last month was the hottest April on record in the world, by the largest margin ever, continuing a record-breaking trend. Ocean fish, saltwater fish, will become extinct by the year 2050. Also around 2050 come the climate launch dates for major capitals around the world. What's a climate launch date? That's the date when the record high temperature for that place becomes the average temperature for that place. That year will be 2047 in Philadelphia. We are facing the poisoning of the oceans, the despoiling of the land. Precious ecosystems and the biosphere are in turmoil. As I said to one economist friend of mine, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the biosphere. If the biosphere fails, the economy fails. We need only look at the weather that has battered our nation this spring, the massive and unprecedented tornadoes over the heartland, the floods, as in Miami, where I'm retiring, the droughts, as in California, where my son lives, the endless rain, the fires. Over 650 million acres of Canadian boreal forests have burned just this month, with comparable burns in the Northwest and Russia and Alaska in the last couple of years. These forests were sinks for carbon dioxide, absorbing some of the greenhouse gases spewing into the atmosphere. Now they are burning and turning into even greater sources of greenhouse gases. The permafrost in the Arctic is melting, releasing methane, the most toxic of all greenhouse gases, which is also released by fracking. The fires and smoke contribute to the melting of ice in the Arctic and Antarctic, the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, the Antarctic southern ice sheet, warming the oceans, making them more acidic, and also making them rise. It is all interconnected. All of us are downstream from somewhere. The greatest myth that afflicts our society is the myth of separation. There is no separation. Climate scientists now predict that the seas will rise 3 to 6 feet by the end of the century. That would pretty much wipe out the East Coast. By July 4th, 2076, the 300th anniversary of the United States, even Independence Hall will be underwater. Not submerged entirely, but very challenging for a 4th of July parade. And the bad news is that all this weather, all this dying, is the effect of the greenhouse gases spewed into the air 30 years ago, before our graduates were born. There's a 30-year time gap between the emissions and their effects. What will be the effects of the emissions we are spilling out now, 30 years from now? What are we going to do with all the people who live on the coasts of America? What are we going to do with all the people who live on the coasts all over the world? I do not have answers to that. I am retiring to Miami and looking for a condo. I trust that all of you will be aware of these questions and of these emerging events, and that you will grow into the answers. That means opening our consciousness to encompass both the time scales of history and of evolution, both cosmic time and geologic time, which also means holding together both the celebration of what we have accomplished and the grief of what still lies beyond our grasp. We have to hold the big picture and the small picture together. This is an example of our opening, awakening consciousness, which is an emergent property of the universe, after all, and the evolution of the planet whose process has created us. Consciousness is embedded as an emergent property from the first moment of time, from the tiniest single-celled organism to the highest human achievements. We are an articulation of nature and the cosmos. One of the joys of living in this time is the abundance, the knowledge, the widespread of consciousness that circles the globe. Music from the rock and roll of my day has become a million different genres with incredible new instruments, electronic sounds and images, sharing, blending, inventing new forms, a joy of sheer eclecticism, the mixing of all times, cultures, rhythms, and sounds. It's also a time of the joy of a myriad of tastes, the shared and mixed cuisines of all the cultures of the world, the fusion of fashion styles and tastes and objects that proliferate in our homes and public spaces. We have a huge knowledge of the world, of medicine, of plants, of the body itself, understanding health in molecular ways, and reaping as well the learning of ancient and faraway sources. We have, perhaps above all, the accumulated knowledge and learning of every culture that has ever lived on the planet. We have the ability now to read and look at the artifacts and texts, the images and maps of all the greatest books, the greatest art, the greatest architecture that the world has ever produced. And we can hold the wisdom of human beings and non-human beings in our hands. You will have to find ways to think and create reality that I can't even begin to fathom. We have among us, as humans, all that humans have ever been and can be. We can become responsible for all of human history. The world as we know it, the beaches and the forests, the small towns and the great cities, the grassy plains and the wild marshlands, the oaks and maples and pines, the woods we walk through every day, they are all passing away, even though we have not recognized it or acknowledged it. Look around you at the world as you walk through it, as you watch the sunsets and the rain, and cherish it. Hold it close in your heart and engrave it on your mind, knowing that it is already passing. Your children will not live in this world. Your grandchildren may not even be able to find a habitable place to settle. It is too late to stop much of the massive dying of numerous species and fragile ecosystems. We and all species will have to adapt to a world we have never experienced. But we're still here now. The Earth is alive and vital and active, and there will always be those, more and more, I hope, who are loving and fighting on her behalf. Life calls us to her side. Hope is something you do, not something you have. We are witnessing a rising solidarity of consciousness and life over vast temporal and global fields. We can see ourselves as part of a larger movement arising from all over the world. For the sake of life itself, give your strength and your brilliance, your beauty and your creativity, your brains and your energy to saving what's left of our planet. It takes consciousness and sharing large and small shifts in attention and perspective every day that ripple out like waves to reach the people around us. I ask my classes sometimes, what is it that all the people in the world have in common? They look at me blankly. Oh, come on, what is it that all the people in the world have in common? They stare back at me. Someone says, there's nothing all the people in the world have in common. We're intellectuals. I say, yes, there is. All the people of the world have the earth in common. They have the stars and the moon and the sunlight and the forests and the rain. Every creature of the earth has walked on the earth in the night, looked at the stars, and felt the light and warmth of the sun in the day and the cold of the rain. This we all share. We are creatures of the earth. I always expect them to fall off their chairs with astonishment. But they just look chagrined. They knew that. Saving this earth as much as you can is the task the universe has set for you. It is the most formidable, frightening task I can think of. And I have utter faith, because I know you, that you will be up to the task. Thank you.